Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Piggy against Carl Sandburg College. Mr. Heller.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the court, my name is Brian Heller. I represent the plaintiff appellant. Cartoons and caricatures that give offense to some has sparked debate around the globe. The guardians of free expression are faced with a challenge to preserve the exchange of free ideas in the face of such objections. This case presents the Seventh Circuit with that challenge in a college setting, in what the Supreme Court has characterized as peculiarly the marketplace of ideas. A student's time at college is a time of questioning, learning, and exploring ideas and assumptions. It's in this environment that a 23-year-old student initiated discussions regarding religion and his own homosexuality with an instructor, who in turn subsequently provided religious tracts to that student.
Mr. Heller, do you think it would be permissible at a public college for an instructor to devote 5 minutes of each classroom or class period to instruction in that person's own religion?
Depending on the subject matter and the policy of the college, but that is not...
Why does that depend? Do you think in a public school college it would be permissible to take 5 minutes to say, and now we're going to discuss, you know, fill in the blank, you know, Catholicism, and I'm going to take 5 minutes each day because I regard it as important to make sure that my students know the precepts of that religion?
If it related to the subject matter that was being taught and the college didn't object to it, I don't think that there would be a problem. But that's
not... To teach people the religion?
Pardon?
I mean, certainly, sure, if it's a history of religion class where you're not trying to convert people but simply trying to instruct them, that's one thing. But I guess I'm trying to ask you, if you spent 5 minutes in each class trying to persuade people that Catholicism was the best way to go, religiously speaking, you think in a public school that's permissible? It's an interesting view of the Supreme Court's Establishment Clause jurisprudence.
Well, I'm not suggesting if the 5 minutes is simply, rather than being instructional, is totally a proselytizing, that would be appropriate.
But so you would agree that, in fact, proselytizing in a public school, of course, if somebody wants that, there are plenty of church-based schools one could go to, but in a public school you can't proselytize on classroom time.
On what is, yes, known as classroom time. And there is, the defendants here have admitted that the plaintiff never did that in instructional classroom time.
That's I think, shaving it in a different way, because this happens to be a field where clinical instruction is part of the educational process. Many fields are like that. Medical school is, others are as well. And so I guess there's an issue, I'm not sure whether you think it's an issue of fact, as to whether this clinical instruction time should be regarded as instructional time or free time somehow.
Well, it's a combination of both. It's a unique setting in that you have...
It's not unique at all, as I've just said. Do you think medical residents are being instructed or not?
Well, they certainly are, but the uniqueness is that what you have is a beauty salon setting.
I know, and a medical resident has a hospital setting. All sorts of people come to hospitals.
Yeah, but they typically don't, as a part of gathering at the hospital, engage in a free range of debate and discussion.
They don't?
I don't think that type of thing may occur on occasion in a hospital. In the hospital waiting rooms I've sat in, that's not what was on people's minds. But certainly in barbershops and beauty salons, people are discussing the topics of the day in free-ranging discussions. And that is, in fact, what the record established was happening here, that the students, the general public coming in, the instructors were engaging in all manners of conversation. Regarding religious things, sexual behavior, topics of the day, sports, what you would expect people to talk about. And that there was the college, and in fact, in the 20 years that the plaintiff had worked there, had never tried to control those discussions.
Well, of course they wouldn't try to control the discussions of the clients, but in some of the student evaluations in this record, it appears that the students were taught not to speak of their own personal religions in the salon.
Why?
One student wrote, "Miss Piggy usually inquires into her religion into every day. Some people don't always agree with what she feels. I think that if we are taught that we are not to speak of our religions in the salon, neither should she." That's in the record.
Yeah, that is an evaluation that's in the record that the administration apparently didn't think was of any importance. They never brought it to Miss Piggy's attention. They never in any way told her that she was doing anything wrong with respect to that, even though that evaluation went to her superiors.
I wonder if you could tell me what the essence of the complaint, you have a lot of theories in your brief, what the essence of your complaint is, because of course after the incidents at issue here, nothing happened to her in terms of salary, duration of contract. What happens is she doesn't get a renewal of the contract, a new contract, as it were. So I want to know, you know, what the focus of this complaint is. Is it her self-censorship during the second half of that fall, or is it the failure to get a new contract? What's your argument here?
Well, I think there's three critical points. Number one, there is the self-censorship because of the draconian order that came down to her that you're not supposed to talk about social, sexual issues, you know, anywhere on campus. And it is emphasized religious issues you are not supposed to discuss. So certainly I'd say that is my primary focus, that prior restraint that was imposed on her for the duration of the semester, and which the college instructor or administration claimed was part of the policy of the whole college. That was their claim. There's not much evidence that they told the rest of the college. So that's point number one. Point number two was this bogus finding that she had violated the sexual harassment policy, which just seems completely inappropriate use of the policy. And then third, that they didn't renew the contract. She'd worked there steadily for the past 3 years, and
why did she have a right to renewal of the contract? What precisely about the non-renewal was a legal problem? She doesn't have tenure.
Correct. But she can. The defendants could have chosen to not renew her contract for any reason or no reason, but they can't do it for an illegal reason. And the illegal reason was that simply because she had invited this student to continue a discussion which the student had initiated.
Well, their argument was that she was inserting her religion into the instructional process in a way that was inappropriate, and they would have done the same thing to anyone else. That you know, it was a neutral reason. They didn't really care what the content was. It was disruptive for this student.
Well, I mean, the student filed a complaint, yes. If you look at the evidence in the record, is he continued to go to classes and he finished the semester and she continued to be his instructor and there were no problems.
And he complained very seriously about it.
He complained about it.
She reduced him to tears, you know.
Every teacher is going to have a student that at some point doesn't like something that they've done or said. That shouldn't be the basis of dismissing a teacher. And the proof was in the pudding, and the pudding was as soon as the college made her aware there was a complaint, there never was a problem. There's no evidence there was a problem. The instruction continued. The administration was so unconcerned they didn't even check back for the rest of the semester to see if there was any problem. So for them to suggest that there was this terrible problem, there was going to be disruption, number one, they didn't do anything about it at the time other than tell her, and then they didn't check about it. Now that doesn't suggest that it rose to this great level of concern that the educational environment, you know, was going to be destroyed. At that level of unconcern, to simply decide, okay, well, one student, you know, was unhappy with her for a few days, therefore we don't renew her contract. That's what that puts a chill on any teachers that don't have tenure communicating with a student. Because you could say something that was offensive to them. And
well,
boom,
that, of course, wouldn't violate anything.
I just don't understand what's wrong with that. I mean, suppose some teacher decides, after the Supreme Court's decision saying that the Establishment Clause forbids prayer at public schools, some teacher says, well, my religion requires me to pray. I'm going to lead the New York Regents Prayer in this class for anybody who chooses to join in.
Well, if the teacher...
And the school responds to that by not renewing her contract. I mean, what could the problem possibly be?
If the teacher did that back in their office or in the hallway with the student in non-instructional time, I guess I don't see what the problem is. We're dealing with adults on a college campus.
Perhaps because you haven't read the Supreme Court's school prayer decisions.
Well, which are all in the high school context in part of a...
No logical limit. The rationale of those decisions is roughly that the teacher's behavior puts pressure on the student to conform to a religious point of view. That was, of course, your client's very objective, to put pressure on a student to conform to a religious point of view. The Supreme Court said that's not within the power of the state. And it's very difficult to see the point that the state can't enforce that rule. But that's what you're arguing. If the teacher decides that she wants to put religious pressure on a student, the state can do nothing about it.
But that's ignoring the fact that the student initiated a conversation with the teacher both about his religion and his sexual behavior.
Look, it doesn't make any difference. One of the Supreme Court's prayer cases was a prayer read by a student.
Well, but that was in the context where the administration was setting up the framework for the student to do that.
No, but what Judge Easterbrook is pointing out, which this court's decisions are quite clear on, is that the state, capital S state, in this instance, this college, cannot put pressure on people to conform to a point of view. And it can say to its instructors, if you're going to be an instructor here, that's something you just have to leave at home.
You have to do it.
You can't do that.
Well, if the court is suggesting that religious viewpoints is that public college campuses are a religious viewpoint free zone, that doesn't seem to me to be within
It's the instructor student relationship. It's like the workplace cases, which are not untrammeled, you know, First Amendment zones. There's a well-established analysis for these kinds of places. And the instructor, in even a clinical instruction setting, is still the instructor and still has to be aware of that role.
Well,
it's not like on Sunday Mr. Rule went over to her house and said, I'd like to go to church with you. Is that okay? That would be a completely different case, it seems to me.
Well, on a college campus, when a student outside of class comes
but
to
your,
a teacher...
But your premise is outside of class. What happened that triggered this case was in the instructional setting.
As the student had checked out for the day, the teacher was on a break, and the testimony at page 184 of the... plaintiff's deposition was that she, ever since the student had initiated the discussion with her, she was looking for the opportunity to provide this information to him. Now, if stepping a couple feet outside the door of the cosmetology building would have made the constitutional difference, I don't think and the administration said they would have had no problem if she had stepped 2 feet outside the door handed it, the literature to him.
The administration may be giving too much away if the teacher in the school follows the student out the door and says, let's pray now. I think you're in trouble.
Well, if the teacher says, would you like to continue the discussion about this topic, and the student declines and the teacher never brings it up again, I guess, I don't see how that is pressuring the student. And in fact, there is no evidence that there was any pressure, any effect on the student's grade or anything in what the teacher's actual teaching of the class. So I see my time has expired, and I'll close. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Heller. Mr. Piskorski.
I'm curious to see what you can add to what has been said.
I hope to add something, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Thomas Piskorski on behalf of all of the defendants' appellees. I think it's critical to begin that this is a summary judgment case and to underscore that there are no genuine issues of material fact. What the plaintiff did, why she did it, what she said, what her intent was, is all undisputed in this case. It comes from her own testimony. This is not a case about academic discussion generally, something tied to the course content, something that could be curriculum justified. This was a cosmetology teacher.
But Mr. Piskorski, let me tell you the two things that concern me about your side. One of them is that, as Mr. Heller argued and explores in his brief, this does seem to be a pretty poor fit for the sexual harassment policy. I could imagine writing general harassment policies or even possibly a sexual harassment policy that might apply, but this particular one didn't strike me as much of a fit with what went on. And the second thing that's troublesome is the question of how broad a prohibition was this. If somehow it had been very clear that within the instructional setting, you know, that the student-teacher relationship somehow she was not to proselytize to students or in any other way try to coerce them into following her religious viewpoint, that's one thing. You know, an eternal muzzle might be another thing.
Let me take your first question on the policy. While it may not be a direct fit, the policy does cover sexually related conduct. And the pamphlets, the tracts that were provided by the plaintiff to the student, are very sexually graphic. They are oriented towards gay individuals, but the content of the material is very sexually related. And under the sexual harassment policy, whether it's a private workplace or a public workplace, the employer has a strong interest in ensuring that that type of material is not distributed. Secondly, the policy is applicable because of the harassment element. Again, the conversation or the action by plaintiff towards the student was driven by his sexual orientation. There is a sexual component to it. So for those reasons, while it may not be the classic sexual harassment case, it does legitimately fall within the policy. Regarding the breadth of the prohibitions, I think you have to read the two Benny letters and the committee report. The context of all of those communications were very limited and based on the student's complaint, the plaintiff's specific conduct. And each letter and the committee report references that as the basis for what they were saying. The last letter from Benny, might it be a tad overbroad? Maybe. But in the context, if you read the first paragraph of the letter, what he was addressing was the conduct that precipitated the investigation and was precipitating his action. And there, the conduct was undisputed, and his prohibition was, don't proselytize your students. Don't try to convert them. Don't try to change their sexual orientation. This is a student-teacher relationship. A lot of power, a lot of influence, a lot of authority. So the breadth of the prohibitions, I think, is a fake argument here. They're manufacturing that there's an issue about the breadth of the prohibitions, but when you read the context of the letters and the language of the letters, I don't think there's any genuine issue what was being prohibited by the vice president.
Do you think if the college had said, as long as there is a student-teacher relationship, you may not proselytize any of your students anywhere, whether you're in, you know, San Francisco on a holiday or whether you're on the college campus or whether it's Saturday afternoon at a football game?
That might raise some overbreath issues if the student in a different forum, whether it's at a football game or at a conference or a church gathering or a social gathering, opens up the discussion and asks for material or something. That's certainly different, Your Honor. So there's so many hypotheticals that could be raised here. So I think that would require the college to look carefully to see what are our interests. Do we have any interest in that factual scenario? But the college was not attempting to make some sweeping prohibitions here. They were attempting to address a particular complaint based on particular conduct by one of their faculty members. And this is not a faculty member who was just dealing with a student in another department. She taught him. She had an effect on his grades, his advancement in the college, potentially career opportunities. She was a big influence over him. And she's telling him, you've got to change because of my personal beliefs. That puts that young man in a very, very difficult position on those points. Plus, I don't think it's particularly arguable that that really could hurt somebody emotionally. As the district court said, that really could affect somebody's self-esteem and self-worth to have your teacher attack you like that. And this is more than just general discussion. Not that it might matter, but this was really rough material, really rough communication. She was telling him, literally, you know, you're garbage and you're going to hell if you don't change. I can't imagine any scenario where that's justified absent some very compelling facts. That's bad stuff. And the college, she not only did not have the right to do it, but on the other side of the coin, I think the college had a compelling interest to stop it. It couldn't allow its students to be harassed and intimidated and threatened and coerced like that. I can't imagine any reasonable teacher saying, oh, yeah, that'd be okay.
Now, along that line, does this policy then, in your view, make any difference? Is it enough that there's a policy, let's say, embodied in the First Amendment to the Constitution, saying you can't establish religion, or does the college need a particularized policy? It was one of her arguments. If I didn't agree with you on the applicability of the sexual harassment policy, what difference would that make?
It wouldn't make any, because the record shows we don't have a no proselytization policy at the college, but it's not necessary. The law is clear that public employers, such as Carl Sandburg, cannot establish religion, cannot force individuals to adopt or not adopt a particular religion. That's a given. You don't need a written policy. You don't even need to announce it. The law is such that the college could not do it. So it was merely enforcing what its legal obligations were.
But, of course, colleges do have to treat religious speech in some contexts equally with other speech. We know from Rosenberger, we know from other cases, that you can't disfavor religion.
Agreed, Your Honor. Those are different cases, and we can debate hypotheticals. But this was a particular action based on particular conduct. And for that conduct and for that action, it wasn't necessary to have some formalized policy to say, hey, teachers, you can't hand out sexually graphic and disgusting materials to gay students so that you can change their lifestyle. That's essentially what the plaintiff is arguing in this case, that the college should have given me notice that that conduct was improper and that I might be disciplined for it. You know, on its face, that seems a very strained argument, that a college has to tell teachers that. That's a given. I can't imagine any reasonable teacher believing otherwise, and that's the district court's rational finding here, because I think the district court got it just right. You know, students like the student in this case and their parents are not paying good money to have their lifestyles questioned and their self-esteem shattered by teachers who, for personal reasons, disapprove of their sexual orientation or some other fundamental personal characteristic. I just don't see this as a hard situation. Yes, you can create hypotheticals that might cause one to at least step back and think about it. But this case doesn't even come close to that based on the admitted conduct, the admitted purpose of the conduct, and plaintiff's unwavering position, even during investigation, I'm going to do what I have to do. She never got it. She still thought throughout the process that I absolutely have the right to do this, and you can't tell me otherwise. That's not a particularly good approach to take when the college believes your conduct is improper. She's literally saying, do what you have to do, but I'm going to keep doing this. So you're going to repeat this conduct? Oh, that's pretty hard for any employer, let alone this employer, an educational institution who's there to make sure students...
By the way, why is a public college running a cosmetology school?
It's a community college, Your Honor, and they provide a lot of trade programs, such as hair cutting.
But no law school.
There is no law school at Carl Sandburg.
Rank discrimination.
So is it a two-year program? Is it a one-year program?
It varies, Your Honor. I can't remember what the cosmetology program is. I believe it's 2 years, but I'm not sure. I think this court's...
Do they have a plumbing school?
I do not know, Judge. The couple of cases that are quite important, I think, this court's decision in Venters versus the City of Delphi, in the very end of that opinion, the language is so right on point. I urge the court to look at it. And Bishop v. Aronoff, the Eighth Circuit case, it really lays out all of the interests. But ultimately, it boils down to the plaintiff had no legitimate interest in doing what she did. And the college had not just a legitimate interest, but in our minds, a compelling interest to stop it, particularly in this academic setting with a student-teacher relationship and all that goes into that. We ask that the judgment be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Piskorski. Anything further, Mr. Heller?
I'd like to first address the breadth of the prior restraint. The defendants have tried to say, well, all this was just a reaction to this specific incident, which was handing a student a piece of literature and inviting him to talk about it. In fact, when the administrators met with the plaintiff, they told her that instructors, not just her, but all instructors, supposedly, on the college, Carl Sandburg College campus, were not to talk about religion with students, period. And that was repeated at a second time that she met with the administrators. So then, secondly, the Dean of Human Resources, with whom Mr. Benny, who wrote the thing, the written prohibitions, consulted, specifically asked, when the student approached the teacher after class and engaged in this discussion about religion, would this written policy have precluded the teacher from responding? And her answer was yes, that it was intended to stop a teacher from talking to a student after class about a religious topic. Now, that's the answer in the record. I mean, the defendants, there is no contrary evidence that's in the record either. So that's by their own admission. That written policy was intended to be much broader than anything that any court has ever required. And in fact,
suppose the policy instead had said, we don't want teachers discussing appropriate birth control methods or abortion with students. And if a student approaches you, you just have to say, that's not a topic that we're going to discuss with you. You know, you can go seek assistance elsewhere.
Well,
would you have a problem with that?
On a college campus, yes, I think I would with dealing with adults.
What if it just said you can't talk about abortion with students?
Sounds
a lot like a law I've heard of. So.
Well, I'm not aware of any law that said that a teacher or instructor outside of class in a college setting couldn't talk about abortion. But we're talking even much broader than just a particular subject. We're talking about the whole viewpoint and area of religion is off limits on the Carl Sandburg College campus, according to the administrator's own testimony. Now, the Bishop case, which the defendants want you to follow, specifically said, of course, if a student asks you a question about your religious beliefs in the classroom, you can fairly answer. Now, the Bishop case is, as far as I know, is the most restrictive case, and which is why they cite it, that's out there. But it specifically held that even in the classroom, a professor could answer a student's question. This policy was saying even outside the classroom, you can't. To me, that clearly was an overbroad, unlawful prior restraint. There's nothing that would justify that, and the Establishment Clause cases to the contrary, because these Establishment Clause cases are almost uniformly concerned with the student as a captive audience, not the student initiating a discussion about a subject. And so they simply aren't applicable to this kind of situation, again, with an adult deciding to initiate the subject matter. Then with respect to the sexual harassment policy, again, I would suggest that the actual language of the policy, which indicates that the harasser had to have an intention to harass or intimidate, or that there was some perception on their part that they were harassing and intimidating, that there's no way that this conduct, a one-time giving a piece of literature, asking, inviting a discussion about it, that rises to the level of harassment or in any way fits the language of this policy. And then finally, the defendant's claim that the teacher's reaction upon being confronted, that she had the right to do it, you have to look at the context of what she was responding to. And she was responding to these administrators telling her that nowhere on Carl Sandburg College campus could she talk about religion to a student. And she found that unfathomable, that here she is in this clinical setting where all these other instructors are talking about politics and religion and sexual behavior and what they did last night with their boyfriend, and she is specifically being prohibited to talk with any student anywhere on campus about religion. And she can't comprehend that. Now, I have a difficulty comprehending it myself. Knowing a little bit more about the law, I can't understand such a broad prohibition, and it's understandable that she couldn't either. For all those reasons, I would ask that the court reverse and send this matter back for trial. Thank you.
The case will be taken under advisement.